No wise man will wish to bring more long words into the world, but it may be allowable to say that we need a new thing, which may be called psychological history. I mean the consideration of what things meant in the mind of a man, especially an ordinary man, as distinct from what is defined or deduced merely from official forms or political pronouncements. What did soldiers feel when they saw splendid in the sky that strange totem that we call the golden eagle of the legions? What did vassals feel about those other totems, the lions or the leopards upon the shield of their lord? So long as we neglect this subjective side of history, we may more simply be called the inside of history, which may more simply be called the inside of history. There will always be a certain limitation on that science which can be better transcended by art. So long as the historian cannot do that, fiction will be truer than fact. There will be more reality in a novel, yes, even in a historical novel. Welcome to Pints with Chesterton, a podcast where two millennial women dive into the wonderful and whimsical works of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. I'm Grace.
And I'm Marie. On today's episode, we are discussing Chapter 7 of Part 1 of The Everlasting Man, The War of the Gods and Demons. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Marie. And hi, Lucy.
Yes, we have a special guest here tonight. We have a special guest. Lucy, can you say Chesterton?
That wasn't her first word? Come on.
Yeah, right? We have not been accepting bedtime, so we're all together tonight. Grace, it's so good to see you. It's been a couple weeks, but we're back. We're talking about this wonderful chapter.
Are you drinking anything?
I am. I'm drinking port again tonight.
Nice.
I'm enjoying it very much. It's been already a long week and it's already it's just Monday, so the kids are giving me a run for my money. What are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking an awesome beer called Delirium Tremens. Okay. It has a pink elephant.
Very cool can.
Yeah. It's a Belgian ale. It's very good. I'm recording at my friend's house tonight because I am en route to Colorado for a vacation. And my friend's husband used to work for a beer distributor in New Orleans. And so they have lots of great beers all the time at their house.
Oh, awesome. How fun. Are you going to Crested Butte soon?
I am. Yeah. So tomorrow is a long day of travel. I have to fly into the Denver airport, take a train to downtown Denver, get on a bus, and drive 6 hours into the mountains. So,
oh, wow. Okay. Oh, my goodness. Have you been reading anything good lately?
Honestly, I've been trying to understand this chapter. So that's mostly what I've been reading.
I totally am right there with you.
Yeah, it's there hasn't been much else besides that. And summer is kind of crazy and all over the place because I'm doing a lot of traveling. So I'm hoping, though, this week to be able to read some things, but just Chesterton for now.
Cool.
How about you?
I just finished a book by E.C.R. Lorak, she writes murder mysteries.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a really fun read. She was of the last century. I don't know exactly when, but I think sort of a contemporary with Agatha Christie and all of the people in the crime detection club and all of that. Yeah, it was a fun read. I've read a few of her murder mysteries, honestly, as a way to just like unwind and have leisure time more than anything else, which is quite funny, but it's always fun trying to figure out a puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what those books are.
Totally. Yeah, I agree with that. I think both of us are very Chestertonian that way. We like
yes.
murder mysteries and things, or just mysteries in general.
Yes.
I haven't been reading. I honestly, I think it's just because it's summer and I'm like in lazy mode, but I never really watch TV, but I've been rewatching my little guilty pleasure murder mystery show, Death in Paradise. Have I told you about that?
I have seen Death in Paradise on various, and I have not watched it. Is it really good?
I love it. It's not.
Oh my gosh.
It's not good in the sense of like high production quality, like high acting quality. Like, it's not like that. It's like good. It's not like bad. It's just, it's not like a, you know, masterpiece mystery or something like that. It's not that caliber.
Okay.
but it's really fun and it's really funny and it's really cute and it's set in the Caribbean.
Oh.
And I love all things Caribbean, so it's just fun that it's like British murder mystery meets Caribbean, which are two of my favorite things that don't normally come together. So
I love that.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Knives Out or what was that?
No, I need to.
Okay, you've got to watch it. It was actually really well done.
Yeah, I've heard it's awesome.
There was another one that I'll find out the name of it and put it in the notes of this episode, but David and I watched a couple more modern murder mystery films, and we were really pleased with them. Usually we only like the old stuff.
Yeah,
so.
Same. Have you seen All Murders in the Building? I think that's what it's called.
No.
I haven't watched that yet, but I've heard like rave reviews of that. It's like with Selena Gomez and then like Steve Martin or something, and Martin Short.
Steve Martin. Yes.
Yeah.
I saw them like going around doing interviews together, but I didn't know what it was for.
Yeah, I think a couple of my friends have watched that and said it was amazing and that I should watch it. But it's a show, but it's like an ongoing, like they're trying to solve these murders that are happening in their building that they live in New York. And anyways, I think it's in New York.
That's really fun.
Yeah,
I like that. Yeah, I've read that, but I've really been struggling to read, and maybe it's the same thing, maybe summer.
Mm-hmm.
I almost feel like it's summer blues, like I don't want to be sitting reading because there's just so much, like I can finally be outside in the beautiful weather and I just want to do that, but I have been reading this book and this chapter was a bit of a struggle for me, but I think I finally understand it to be sort of a bridge chapter.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is he's not really saying too much in this chapter, but he is, I think, putting one of those final pieces of the puzzle in place to then talk about Christianity more in depth.
Yes.
And once I realized that, I kind of relaxed a little bit and wasn't like, I was trying to find something really, really profound in this chapter, and I think he's just kind of like giving us a little bit more of the historical connection here.
Yeah, and I think he in this chapter is really trying to get us to understand that history is more than just material history or like economic history, which we can tend to think of it that way and we can tend to study it that way, but he, I think, is trying to argue that real history, real interesting history, history that matters, like what makes human history different than like the history of cows or the history of goats that he mentions in this chapter. And so again, he's trying to like make this point that man among all the creatures is very different, and we're very different because we have intellect and will.
Right.
And it's like our intellect and will that contributes to this very interesting arc of history, because we do wild things based on aspirations and dreams that like cows and goats don't have, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's like you said, just kind of a final like flourish on like this point that he's been making throughout these chapters. Yeah. And then a couple of other things as well. So I guess we can just jump right into that.
Yes, let's jump in.
Okay.
I liked what he talked about with the cows.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was,
he's
so
like
funny.
A 12-part volume or 12 volumes on cows would not be very interesting.
Yes, I laughed.
Never
really
thought about that, but yes.
I laughed really hard at the, he said, even the more active quadruped has not inspired a book for boys called Golden Deeds of Gallant Goats or any similar title, which I just love.
I loved that.
So
it's so good.
Yeah. So anyway, again, just like making the point that he's been making this whole time. And I think in the beginning of the chapter, he's trying to say like a Marxist reading of history is going to say like economics, like materialism, like this is what's driving history is economics. It's like getting the money or it's getting the stuff, you know, like food and all this kind of stuff, which is important. But Chesterton's arguing that like the soul of man is really what's driving history. And like those things are necessary for us to survive, but they're not the things that make us actually thrive. They're not the things that we are like setting goals for, like that are deeper than that. And I thought it was really interesting that the proof that he used of this was he mentioned it very briefly, but he talked about suicide as like a proof of that.
Yeah.
And how a person doesn't do that, you know, purely because like they don't have material possessions, but there's something deeper in like a meaning of life sort of sense. And I thought, he doesn't mention this, but I was thinking about, and I used to talk about this a lot when I was teaching, that like it seems in celebrity news, you know, we have all these celebrities these days that are like multimillionaires, and they like basically can snap their fingers and get whatever the heck they want materially in life.
Yeah.
And yet so many of them, we hear reported year after year after year after year, take their own lives. And the question might be like, why? You know what I mean? There's something deeper than just the material things of history. And there's something deeper that's driving the human spirit. There's things that we long for that are much deeper than what is on the surface.
Yes. And we've all experienced that. I experienced that myself. I have all of my material needs met, thank God, and all of the material needs of my family met. And I still feel really down sometimes, or really in a funk sometimes, or just like out of sorts, and you know, have to figure out why I'm feeling that way. So
yeah,
I mean, on a much greater level, if people don't have God in their life at all, then they're sort of just adrift at sea when those sorts of feelings or experiences happen that make you feel like maybe life isn't worth living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the point that Chesterton, I think, is making is like these deeper questions of like what is it that is the meaning of life? Like what makes life meaningful?
Yes.
What are these deeper things that we desire more than the spiritual things, you know? So, yeah. And then he goes on and he's talking about like, why fight a war? Which is kind of a big, I guess, part of the chapter is the idea of war. And he's saying that while governments may declare war based on material things, like what sustains the fighters, what sustains the soldiers, like what keeps them fighting,
what convinces them to die for something. Yeah.
And he makes the point that it's not the material things that they're dying for. And I thought this quote was so good. He says, does anybody in the world believe that a soldier says, my leg is nearly dropping off, but I shall go on till it drops, for after all, I shall enjoy all the advantages of my government obtaining a warm water port in the Gulf of Finland.
Yeah.
It's just like the reasons given for fighting a war, like on a governmental level, are not why the soldier is on the ground willing to lose his leg, like in this battle.
Yeah. He mentions in this section that there's no way that millions of men could be ruled merely by force, right? Because if they all revolt, then that's over. You know, nobody's in control of them anymore. But that there has to be an incredibly strong motivation for them to give their lives, or to potentially give their lives for something like this, which I think is what the Marxist approach to history leaves out. He talks about how it leaves out religious wars and many other things, and it ignores the part of man that, like you said, that is desire, that has desire beyond the basic necessities. And I wrote a note to myself here that it reduces all of these people to just like cogs in the wheel of production. And we're not merely people who produce. And then a history like that then basically calls everyone who's not a part of that production, like there's plenty of people who can't participate, I guess, efficiently in society, but who are meaningful parts of society.
Right. So but it's like you're not
a history like that leaves that out.
Totally. And you're not like, you know, back to the war thing, it's like you're not really like dying for product, you're dying for an idea, you're dying for something that you see to be like the like what he Chesterton was saying in that quote that we said in the beginning, like the feeling of your country or the feeling of your family or the feeling of like you know, this atmosphere that you're used to living in and that you believe is good, and you're fighting against something that you believe is the antithesis of that, that's trying to take it away. So Chesterton says, like, you fight for two reasons: for the love of something said to be threatened, and the dislike and defiance of some strange thing that threatens it.
And he says they may be fighting for something only vaguely known as home. But they're fighting for a house, basically. Like, they're protecting something very personal and intimate.
And it's not just the house itself. Like, he mentions at some point where, like, if they were said to say, like, what are all the things that are in your house that you're fighting for, they, like, probably couldn't name them. But it's, like, something more than just, like, the physical house and the physical stuff, you know?
Yeah, he says if your house was burnt down, you could hardly count all of the things that you would miss.
Right. But there's that feeling of home that remains, you know? I like the line he said where men fight the hardest when they feel that the foe is at once an old enemy and an eternal stranger, that his atmosphere is alien and antagonistic. So if you can see the enemy, like in a war, for example, as something that is completely antagonistic to you, that's something that is like their culture, their ideology, what they believe, what they live is like so foreign to what we believe in here, you know, then that helps you to like
detach,
fight against. Against that, and to defend what you believe in.
Yeah, if we start to try to understand somebody else, then we don't necessarily want to hurt them. Or if we think about them too much like another person.
Yeah.
At first, this is part of why men go to war, right?
Totally.
And not us, because we would think of them as people probably the whole time.
Yeah, there is something, I think, in that complementarity of the sexes that's... Yeah, they're different for sure. But I thought it was interesting when he first said men are moved by or moved in these things by something far higher and holier than policy, by hatred. At first I was like, ooh, I don't know how I feel about that. But then I was like, oh, OK, like I see what he's saying. It's like hatred of this idea of what's opposite of what you believe to be good. And whether or not, I think if you're looking at history, like whether or not that actually is true or not, like maybe the people that you're fighting against are not totally antagonistic or aren't totally opposite of what you believe, but you convince yourself of that, that propels you, you know, into this war or whatever. But the point, again, coming back to this idea that it's not about the material things, it's about the ideas, it's about something that's spiritual, something that's deeper than just like these material things you're fighting for, like a warm water port in the Gulf of Finland.
I like how he says this. He says there's a religious war when two worlds meet. That is, when two visions of the world meet, in more modern language, when two moral atmospheres meet. It's like when two such drastically different moral standards come head to head, there's going to be conflict. I mean, Carthage and Rome were so different.
Yeah, yeah.
He also says a little bit later in the chapter, I hope you don't mind if I jump a little farther towards the end. He says that the Romans hated the hateful soul of Carthage, and which was what you were just summing up, basically. It's like they have to look at them objectively and say, how is this society behaving? How are they treating these human beings here?
What's the philosophy and really the religion that they're following, and like, how is it affecting their whole society? And I think that, again, throughout this book so far, Chesterton has been taking us on a tour of what he would say is like actually like world religions class, you know, comparative religions or whatever. And he's saying how he said in the beginning how it's not accurate to say like, oh, here's Christianity and here's Judaism and here's Islam and like here's paganism, because there's like very different types. And I think he's trying to make the point in this chapter that the paganism of like Greece and Rome is very different, categorically different, than the paganism of Carthage, for example. That it's like there's these kind of whimsical, like almost harmless, like gods of Greece and Rome that kind of had like a deeper meaning but like weren't actually real entities. And then you have the gods of Carthage, which he argues basically, I think, there are demons, because you have child sacrifice and things that are happening that are truly demonic, and that there's more at work here. There's these negative things that are, he talks about how people will resort to like these negative powers, feeling that they're somehow more effective.
Right.
Yeah. And like things actually happen, and they're very bad things and very dark things. But
something is happening.
I think in like Chesterton's World Religions class right now, he's like putting these things in different categories for us to see. And that's why it's effective for Rome to fight against Carthage, because they see that. They see this is something that is the antithesis of what we believe, sacrificing, you know, your own children to the gods, is the opposite of what we're after.
Yeah, he's saying that's worth having a religious war over.
Right.
In scripture, it says there's a time for peace and there's a time for war. And this Chesterton is outlining this for us. This is the time for war.
Yeah.
When people are sacrificing their children. And then he gives the example of also the priest having to kill the previous priest to take over for him, like to slay the. And so that's another form of sacrifice, too, that should like tip us off, like, oh, red flag, this is a society that is deeply demonic and not working,
literally destroying itself. And that's right, his thing is like Carthage, he argues in this chapter that Carthage actually destroys itself, even though they're like super powerful at one point. Like his description, I loved his description of like Hannibal coming over the mountains and everything. Yes. And like that was, it was just magnificent. Like his, I mean, just his prose is so good. But it really does. It makes you feel the atmosphere of like what is happening, you know, in this moment. And it feels like there is no way Rome can defeat Carthage. But he says Carthage ends up destroying itself because it follows its ideology. It follows its religion to its natural conclusion, which is that it kills itself, right? It's sacrificing itself to its own gods.
Yeah, it just made me think of that image he gave in last chapter about the snake, the dragon eating itself.
Yes.
You know, the symbol and how it's like to some people that image is like an image of peace and tranquility. But he says to the Christian, it's despair, because it does mean destruction. It does mean consuming oneself. Whereas, interestingly, in Christianity, we're, like, given the command to consume Christ, right?
Yeah, and to live yet, like Christ. That brings life. It brings, like, a higher pitch of life, like an eternal and a divine life that goes ever outward, I think, like the cross, you know?
And it actually, it saves, it doesn't destroy.
Right.
And Christ never calls us to destroy our children or our families.
Yeah. So I think one thing that Chesterton is emphasizing in this chapter is he says it's important to imagine what history could have been. And so he says, like, what if it was Carthage? Like, what if Carthage had won, basically? And what if it was Carthage and the empire of Carthage that existed whenever, you know, Jesus came into the world? That would have been a totally different, like, moment of history, and who knows like what God could have done, but it would have been very different, and maybe less, I wouldn't say like less effective, because again, God can do whatever he wants, but in the sense of like Rome, the way Rome was, it was almost like ripe for the picking. It was like ready for Christ, you know, to come.
Yes.
But if it had been Carthage, it would have been very different.
Actually, Dale wrote something interesting about this in his commentary that I'll read out. Sorry, let me find it.
You're good. I almost read the commentary. I finally have my copy. It took me like 2 months
Yay!
To get.
It came.
It was like a whole fiasco.
A little
with,
too
like,
long.
All of my former addresses. I've like moved way too much. But
yeah.
Anyways, I finally have it, but I refrained from reading the commentary because I was like, if I read Dale's commentary, then I'm just going to want to like parrot everything Dale says.
I have actually found the commentary to be really good and really, I've worried about that too, because we're doing our own podcast on it, but I think it's just kind of assisted. But he says, if Carthage had prevailed, if Rome had been defeated, the 21st century would have arrived much earlier, but without such intervening figures as Dante, Michelangelo, Cervantes, and Shakespeare, who would have been robbed of their artistic opportunities, if not of their very lives, they might have been cooked as babies. And I was like, ooh, Dale. Yeah. So true, though. Yeah. So true, though. I mean, if you allow a society to continue ruling that is literally destroying its children, I mean, that is the pits of despair. Yeah. That is the depths right there.
Yeah. I want to read actually the section where he's describing Carthage and just like its philosophical vision and things like that. But he says this sort of commercial mind has its own cosmic vision, and it is the vision of Carthage. It has in it the brutal blunder that was the ruin of Carthage. The Punic power fell because there is in this materialism a mad indifference to real thought. By disbelieving in the soul, it comes to disbelieving in the mind. Being too practical to be moral, it denies what every practical soldier calls the moral of an army. It fancies that money will fight when men will no longer fight. So it was with the Punic merchant princes. Their religion was a religion of despair, even when their practical fortunes were hopeful.
Mm.
And then he says later, their philosophy of the world had weariness in its very heart. Above all, they were weary of warfare. How should they understand those who will wage war even when they're weary of it? And I think what I was thinking about was like, because, you know, he makes that reference to the 21st century. And I think there's something, yeah, very different, but also very similar going on in our own modern culture. And
yeah,
I just think about the kind of epidemic right now of apathy and how no one is really, it's like in some ways people are fighting, but in other ways they're just apathetic, like weary of like fighting because they don't have this like deep love that would inspire a deep hatred of its opposite, if that makes sense.
Yes.
I think there's like a yes. lack of this understanding and this conviction of like purpose and meaning in life that would make you fight against something that threatened it. And so, yeah, I think that that's like very profound what he's saying, just how he describes Carthage that way of like, oh, we're kind of like over this, you know, but like the Christian can't ever get over the fight, you know, like we have to fight the good fight.
Can't give up.
Finish the race. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't give up. And Christ gives you the strength to not give up. Mm-hmm. He provides it all.
But also like if you deeply know what it is you're fighting for, you realize the life that Christ is offering and you fight against everything that would bring death.
Which is that's what Chesterton is saying about the soldier and
right.
his home.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. There was another question I was going to ask you. It's just kind of general to this chapter. Chesterton says in the quote that we read in the beginning that fiction can be truer than fact.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I absolutely loved it. I loved it because I like fiction so much. No, but I realized when I was reading this, one of the reasons I like fiction so much is for this very reason he's giving. Because he's saying this in the part of the chapter where he's talking about incomplete histories mm-hmm. and how Marxism and other ways of looking at history that leave out religious wars, leave out basically people and in all of their uniqueness, and all of the sort of grimy and beautiful detail that should be included in a history. He's saying that a novel, which is written about fictional characters, but with the experience of the author's life and imagination, and novels are meant to express artistic desires, bodily desires, everything. They're meant to express everything. They're supposed to show us in an artistic way, in story form, who we are as people. Like, we can learn from novels even though they're fictional. Mm-hmm. And I think fiction does that sometimes more effectively than a theology on a paper of theology or something. Mm-hmm. People like hearing stories about other people and it helps them to understand themselves. So I think sometimes novels are better at expressing the human condition and desire.
Yeah, I think they grip us because we can relate. Like, it's very incarnational. It like fleshes out a whole picture, that the whole, like Chesterton uses the word atmosphere. You can't really get the atmosphere of a time and place in history without like the details of people's lives and stories, whether they're fictional or not. It's like kind of painting a picture for you in your mind. Like, even his description of Hannibal was like, he was telling us true things that happen, but he was using this like exaggerated, you know, language, like the stars falling from the heavens and blah blah, you know.
Yes.
And I think that's like scripture, you know. It's like there's these certain moments in scripture. There's obviously books of the Bible that are like eyewitness history, like the Gospels, but then there's other books of the Bible that are true history, like they're actually telling us things that happen, but the way that they're described are trying to elicit this like feeling or this atmosphere of what's going on, the kind of gravity of a situation, or to paint a picture in our minds to help us understand more of the experience of what's going on and not just like these facts.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you. I think it can be so much more powerful, and that's why I think, you know, a lot of times people will say they love Chesterton, and I'll ask him like, oh, have you read any of his fiction? And they'll be like, oh no, I don't really know, I don't really like read a lot of his fiction. And I'm like, ah, I think his fiction's the best. Like, I mean, obviously, yeah,
fiction is where it's at.
I know, I love his nonfiction too, obviously, but like the fiction, I think, is almost more powerful to me. And I think it's because it gets you in the story, like it helps you feel the feelings of like of these truths that he's expressing in his nonfiction. And so and I think that's why I think that's why God becomes man, to like get into the experience of something and reveal himself to us in an experiential way. But I think also why God tells us a story, you know?
Yeah. When you were talking, it reminded me of Father Brown, because even though Father Brown is a fictional priest, murder detective, or no, just detective, not always murder.
Yeah.
He's like just such a lovely character. And, you know, I'm sure there are people who have listened to this show who aren't Catholic and maybe don't know any priests, or they don't know any well, and they just have like some stereotype in their mind. But Grace and I have some of our best friends are priests, and they're just such real, wonderful people. I mean, obviously, we can't vouch for every priest in the world, but like
right,
lots of them. And one of the things that I love about Father Brown is that it just makes a priest into a real man and a real person and character. And it helps you to get to know a little bit of what a priest could be like.
Yeah.
And that's not his purpose. Like, he didn't write it intending that. He wrote it because he had one of his best friends who was a priest, and he based it off of him. But
and just because he really liked murder mysteries, like me and Marie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He was the president of the detection club or the crime club? I think that, oh gosh, that's terrible that I can't remember. But anyway,
detection sounds like they would more proper or something. I don't know.
I feel like it is detection, but I'll look it up. Once again, I can put it in the notes. Yeah, but Chesterton especially does a good job at telling truth in fiction. And I think that a lot of people miss out on fiction, and they shouldn't. So I would give it a try if you are a nonfiction person, stickler.
For sure. I have one last question. I don't know if you have anything else that you want to talk about in this chapter, but I had one that's sort of off the wall. It's kind of right in the middle.
Okay.
I'm trying to find the quote here.
Do you have a page number, Grace?
Yes, 232. He's talking about Greek polytheism and Roman polytheism.
Oh, yes.
And he says, it would seem sometimes as if the Greek polytheism branched and blossomed upwards like the boughs of a tree, while the Italian polytheism ramified downward like roots. Perhaps it would be truer to say that the former branches lifted themselves lightly bearing flowers, while the latter hung down being heavy with fruit. I mean that the Latins seemed to multiply gods to bring them nearer to men, while the Greek gods rose and radiated outwards into the morning sky. I thought that was a beautiful image, and it in some level made sense to me, but I don't really understand why he is differentiating between Greece and Rome there. Did you?
To me, I thought that he was saying that though the Greek and Romans were different about how they saw their gods. I think he says, is it the Romans who it was much more mm-hmm. brought into the home and like a part of everything, that though they were different, though they expressed things differently and the involvement was different, it was both of those were completely different from what he says are the uglier things underneath the cruel kind of paganism. And then he goes into like the priest slaying the other priest.
Got it.
Child sacrifice, all of that of Carthage.
I see. So he's saying like Greece and Rome are in the same category of paganism, which is this kind of harmless, mythical, whimsical, like kind of a part of daily life thing versus
That's what Carthage. I thought.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that makes sense to me. I read it and I was like, I know this is like beautiful, but I don't understand the point of it in this chapter. And I expected him, because he started going and describing like all of the Latin or like the Roman gods and everything in the house and stuff, and I expected him then to go into the like opposite about Greece, but then he didn't. But I think you're right. I think that's what it is, just the contrast.
I don't know if I'm just not knowledgeable enough about that, about Greek mythology versus Roman, but what it made me think of was Catholic architecture, because interestingly, in Eastern Catholic churches, they're constructed in order to bring the heavens down to earth. And in Roman Catholic architecture, it's meant to extend you up to heaven, which is why Roman Catholic churches, they have these incredibly tall ceilings and spires and domes and all of that. And Byzantine or Ruthenian or Maronite, whatever it might be, they might have domes too, but typically the ceiling will be lower. And then the iconography inside will be like bringing Christ down to you. And anyway, I just thought when I was reading this of the image of the tree with the Romans and the Greeks, one going up, one going down, how it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it was kind of how they saw it, like one bringing him into earthly things and one extending us up into heavenly things. But both are kind of right.
I like that. I like that a lot, especially because I love church architecture. That's what I wrote my college thesis on. So
forgot about that.
I love that. I didn't even think of, but that is kind of funny because it's actually the opposite of what Chesterton is saying about their paganism. The Romans reaching down and the Greeks reaching up. And it's like, it's the opposite in the Christian version of that, which is so interesting.
Yes.
But you're so right about that architecture thing. Very cool.
Christ brings it all beautifully to fruition. And then, you know, now we have all of this church architecture to look at.
Yeah, there's a really cool episode. I don't know if anyone out there has ever watched the Catholicism series by Bishop Barron. Highly recommend. I just think those episodes are so beautifully done. But there's an episode on God, just like specifically on what we believe about God as Christians, like what is God, who is God, like that kind of stuff. And there's this moment where he's talking about these like kind of qualities of who we believe God is and like what he has, and he talks about transcendence and immanence, like the immanence of God but also the transcendence of God, which is kind of these two themes that we're talking about. But there's just cool imagery because he's showing like the Cologne Cathedral in Germany, just like so tall and just like reaching up towards the heavens as like this image of transcendence, you know. And then just the immanence of God in like person to person, you know, the fact that God became man and just like as a little baby in the manger, and just it's cool.
That's exactly what I was thinking about, is obviously God is so high above us, and then at the same time he humbles himself and becomes a child.
Yeah. And Augustine says like God is closer to you than you are to yourself. And that's just like wild to think about, you know,
mind
just like
blowing.
The imminence, the closeness, of God. In him we live and move and have our being, you know.
I was reading the Magnificat a couple days ago. It had the hymn of the day was like the Saint Patrick prayer, which I don't know.
I love the Saint Patrick prayer, the breastplate of Saint Patrick or the Lorica.
And I literally cut it out of my Magnificat and like pasted it next to my sink so like I could read it while I was doing
dishes. I
arise
today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity. I love that.
Yes. It's like it's such a powerful prayer. And it just, it reminded me how I need to believe that Christ is with me, and it's not just like a feel good, I hope he's with me. It's like he is really with mm-hmm. me. He's promising that he's with me. Mm-hmm. And I have to like let myself be open to that. I have to believe it. I have to trust it. It's hard to trust.
Oh, preach, girl.
It's so hard.
It's like the entire spiritual life, I'm convinced, is just learning to trust like a child, you know?
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you say that because I feel like I just keep coming back to that.
Yeah.
I'm like, I think I progressed a little bit, and then I'm like, you're not trusting. You're not trusting in what God has promised you. You're not trusting in who he says he is, who you anyway.
I really do think like this is a grace hot take. It's not just me, but it's a hot take that the line, unless you turn and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven, is like it. Mm. It's like, if I'm not like a child, I don't trust the Father. And if I don't trust the Father, like, I've missed the whole point.
Oh.
And yeah, that's tough because you're like, oh, shoot.
That's so tough.
I don't trust the Father. Oh. Help me, Lord.
You know,
give me faith.
It is really hard. It's hard too when you, when you anticipate an entire life ahead of you. The other night I was thinking, what if tomorrow is my last day of living for whatever reason? How exactly would it, what would I exactly want to do? How would I want to be with the people that I see tomorrow and like all of that? And it's so hard to do that though every day.
Yeah.
Especially when it feels like a slog sometimes.
Yeah. And I wonder if like, this is just me thinking off the cuff here, based on what you're saying, but like, I wonder if like the whole idea of like, oh, I have to do all these things on my last day, like, you know, like there's like that Ben Rector song where it's like the last day and he's like doing all the things. Anyway,
checking the list.
Yeah, like all these, like, you know, I'm gonna go get ice cream and I'm gonna go like to the top of the Empire State Building, or I'm gonna, I don't know, like just all these like random things that are on your bucket list, or even just like hanging out with certain people or like whatever. I heard a story one time about like, I don't know, it was like a friar or a monk or something, and somebody asked him like, if you knew that this was your last like 24 hours. And I think he was like playing a game, like a board game or something, or he was like doing something very like mundane. And they were like, if you knew this was your last day, like what would you do? And he was like, I would keep playing this game. Like, I would keep doing what I'm doing. And I kind of wonder if like, as Christians, because we believe that like this world truly is not the end, that like it's only a beginning, and it's also intimately connected with heaven. Like, heaven and earth are so close, like we don't realize because there's this veil, but like actually like our lives continue into eternity, like for better or for worse, and like the people that we're connected to on earth, like if they're in Christ, like, and we're also in Christ, then like in heaven we're even more intimately connected, that like I don't have to think about all the things or all the people or all the whatever, but if I'm just like surrendering to God, it's like all of those things are gonna come
be
out
okay.
Good. Yeah, all things work for good for those who love God. Yeah.
And you couldn't possibly do everything perfectly on your last day anyway,
right?
Like,
right,
how would you see everyone in the world that you want to see,
right? And how would you have peace if you couldn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that trust again. It's like, I'm just a baby in the arms of the Father, and like, he's going to take care of it. So like, what do I have to
worry? And trusting that, I guess too, that you're where you're supposed to be doing the work you're supposed to be doing, loving the people you're supposed to love. Cause there's, tons of places that I am not now.
Yeah.
And only one place that I am. And like Chesterton, he says in, we talked about this when we went through Man Alive, how in order to say yes to one woman, and I think he says this in Orthodoxy too, in order to say yes to one thing, you have to say no to everything else. And he gives the example of marriage, like in order to marry one woman or one man, you say no to all of the rest. And like, that's trust too, to say, I'm going to put all of the rest of this out of my mind. I'm not talking about men right now, but like, just, I'm going to put all of the rest of like, everywhere where I could be useful out of my mind, because this is where my purpose is right now. And this is like where my work
right.
is.
Right. Yeah.
Can you tell him I'm having a summer crisis?
Summer crisis. I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there who can totally relate to that. I definitely can too. In the summer when my work, I mean, I like, please Jesus, one day soon I would have a family. But like right now my life is like the ministry that I do, and the people that I'm around at work. And in the summer that lulls because I'm on a college campus and there's like no one around. It's like just it's very dead. And
yeah.
And I do like every summer I like have a crisis and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. And then I realize like, oh yeah, it's because I'm not like meeting with students and teaching classes and like doing yeah. the things that the Lord has like given me in my life right now, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to like breathe and be like, okay, like this is just natural. Like it's all gonna be fine. Okay. Like you're yeah. gonna survive.
Yeah.
But yeah, I relate and I'm sure that other people can relate as well.
I've talked to a bunch of people who have been in a funk lately and I'm like, we're all going to get out of this funk together. I think we all need time with Jesus.
Yes.
And I
Amen to that.
Haven't been setting it aside for myself. Mm-hmm. And I know that will make a difference. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, pray for me. I'm going to go on this retreat or well, it's not really a retreat, but I'm going to my aunt and uncle's house out in the mountains. But it's just me. I don't have any friends coming with me. So it'll just me and my aunt and uncle. And
it is like a retreat.
It is like a retreat. And I'm going to really treat it like one. I have like a plan of things that I want to like journals that I want to go back over and things that I want to pray with and just kind of like recap the last year and just like remember all the things that the Lord has said and all the things that he's done, because he's done a lot in my life, praise God. And
yes,
I need to like remember, you know. So yeah, so that's gonna be my goal for this little vacation / retreat. So
okay, wonderful. Yes. Okay, well, next time we're going to be talking about the end of the world. And we're getting really close to the end of part one of this book.
Yeah.
And I guess because we're at 50 minutes now, maybe we'll pray for each other and we'll enjoy our next week. And I was about to say, and then we'll go further up and further in. And we will.
Bring a little Lewis in there. Why not?
Yeah. Oh, but Grace, do you have anything else that you want to say before we sign off?
I don't think so. I just hope that you all enjoy lives of wit
and whimsy.
Cheers.
Cheers.